Let's start lecture two. With a review of lecture one. So we said we're interested in computing scattering amplitudes of gluons. And each one of our gluons comes with the following data. They have a momentum vector, a polarization vector, and these two you were very familiar with, I guess, and these guys, which are the color index, which can take any value from 1 to n. Because we're assuming we're dealing with a group un. And in lecture one, we spend most of the lecture dealing with the color structure, which was completely encoded in this collection of numbers, which are the structure constants. And you were left with the exercise, which I hope you all did, of proving. So by now, I hope you all have proven that any three-level scattering amplitude of gluons can be color decomposed as follows. So we decided that it was very important to use calligraphic letters for the amplitude because we're going to call whatever comes here that carries the kinematics attached to a particular trace partial amplitudes. And we were supposed to sum over all permutations modding out by the cyclic group. And I was supposed to give you only a couple of minutes to think why, but I ended up forgetting to ask you at the end of the lecture. So you had all day long, well, you had 24 hours to think why. So I'm not going to forget this time. I'm going to ask you. Do you know why?
You give the trace?
That's the answer, yes. The trace doesn't look like that here, but the trace is cyclic. Of course, it looks obvious that it's cyclic from our pictorial representation, because it's now a circle with just external legs coming out. So there is no beginning and no end. It's just a circle. So any permutation that differs by only a cyclic transformation is already taken into account by the first time you encounter such an object. So we have to mod out by that. And these ones are called partial amplitudes. Now, we did all that, but is it useful? Well, hopefully, yes. Otherwise, we just wasted one lecture. And the reason this decomposition is useful is the following. We can ask the question, what kind of Feynman diagrams can contribute to this amplitude, to this partial amplitude? Know that now we can just choose the canonical ordering and then discuss only the canonical ordering, and then everything else will be computed by using permutations. At least the statements can be pre-derived by just permuting the labels of the particles. So let's not do it for m particles. Let's do it for four particles, where we know every single Feynman diagram that appears. So for four particles, we have these Feynman diagrams. So as we apply the color decomposition, as we did yesterday, these diagrams will contribute to different traces. Now, the question that I want to ask is, which diagrams will contribute to this partial amplitude? Meaning, which diagrams can possibly contribute to the coefficient of that particular trace with this corresponding ordering? So can this one contribute? What do you think? I think so, because as we perform the decomposition of the structure constants that appear here, we're going to blow it up into a circle, and we can produce this ordering, and no problem. When we do the same thing to this one will also contribute. But no matter how hard you try, this one will never contribute to that one. So this one is a no, and this one is a yes. Well, it doesn't look like a major simplification. So from four, we went down to three. But as we increase the number of particles, we're going to see that the combinatorics is always in our favor, and it's going to reduce the problem dramatically. So the answer is yes, it's useful, because the diagrams that contribute to this amplitude only what are called planar trees contribute. So what do I mean by planar? I mean that if I draw a big circle, with the ordering dictated by the trace, whatever Feynman diagram I can take and twist so that I can put it on this disk without crossing any lines is said to be planar with respect to the ordering that I have. So you see that that's true for this diagram, but no matter how hard you try, you won't be able to stick this guy into this disk so that you connect the external legs to the corresponding dots without crossing lines. Okay? It was a question, somebody, I think. No? Okay, good. So this is gonna be very important later on. So let's keep it in mind. But today we want to move on, because really the object we want to compute are these partial amplitudes. We already know everything that there is to know about the color, so we have to know what happens to the partial amplitude. Okay, the first observation is the following. Are these partial amplitudes functions? What do you think? You'd say, well, surely, everything is a function. You just have to tell me a function of what. But it's not a function. If something is not a function, it's a distribution. Let's try to see why. So let's go back for a moment to the calligraphic aid, to the whole object. How do you compute this in quantum field theory? Well, you compute it by taking some correlation function of operators in momentum in coordinate space. You perform a Fourier transform. And from here, you use the LSC technique to compute your amplitude, right? So I won't review LSC because we're not using correlation functions. We're not even supposed to be using Feynman diagrams. But all I want to do is to use this to show you something that happens to the amplitude. We know that whatever correlation function in our field theory we're doing, the answer shouldn't depend on whether we do it here or we do it 10 light years from here, okay? Of course, there are local disturbances like the presence of the Earth and your presence and so on. But if we were doing it in the vacuum and we translate the experiment somewhere else, we are supposed to get the same answer. So this correlation function should be translation invariant. So if we translate this by some vector y, we are supposed to get the same result. But if we get the same result by doing this, now I can reabsorb change variables and reabsorb the y into the definition of the xa's. And what's going to happen is that I'm going to pick up a factor that looks like this, times the original octet. And from the original object, I can compute my amplitude again. So from here, from this schematic derivation, I conclude that whatever this object is, it has to satisfy this very strange looking condition for any y. How can this possibly be? No function will ever do this. Well, but that's not a problem, because we know that if we say that this is not a function, but it's a distribution localized, or it has support only when the sum of these vectors is equal to zero, then we are in business. Now, let me abuse the notation a little bit and say that I'm going to define everything so that the momentum conserving delta function, so that's called momentum conservation, is something that multiplies this whole object. So in principle, I could even define a double calligraphic object. Maybe this one is boldface now. It's calligraphic and boldface. And here is our calligraphic function that I wrote down over there. Okay? So the correct amplitude has a momentum conserving delta function times a function. That function we can color decompose into partial amplitudes. Okay? Well, but this is all boring because you all knew this. But it's always good to get the notation straight, especially the conventions for the fonts that you're supposed to use in your notes. Okay? Very good. Now let's do something else. Let's introduce a new trick. After all, we have to beat Feynman diagrams, so we have to introduce many tricks. Otherwise, there would be no chance. Feynman was a very smart guy. So we did already the color decomposition. That was our first trick. And the next one has to do with the kinematics. And the kinematics, as usual, the trick is to find the best possible variables for your problem. So our trick would be, instead of working with the Lorentz group in the form of SO13, we're going to work in this form, with the double cover SL2C. Okay. So what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is the following. I'm going to take the four vector of Pauli matrices, which is nothing but the identity, and then the three Pauli matrices that you're familiar with, which are these ones. And then every time I see a vector, I'm going to hit it with this vector of Pauli matrices. I'm going to contract the index. So every time I have a momentum vector, I'm going to hit it with my four vector of Pauli matrices. And what am I going to get? I get a matrix. So here is another convention for the notation. So my vector, my matrices are going to be denoted like this. And this is a 2x2 matrix. It's a 2x2 matrix with these components. And you all have seen this, right? Now, the interesting part is the following. If you have a Lorentz transformation, that acts on your vector, okay? How does it act on this matrix? Well, the way it acts is by a 2x2 matrix, an element of SL2C that hits the vector or hits the matrix on the left, and G dagger hitting the vector or the matrix on the right to produce the new one. I'm sure you have all computed the determinant of this matrix once in your lives. But if you haven't, why don't you try? What did you get? It's a 2x2 matrix, so it's very easy. And we get nothing but p squared, p mu, p mu. So the determinant is a Lorentz invariant. And that's a very interesting object. So let's do the following. Let me write here a small aside on determinants. It's also a triviality, but it's nice to write it. So if you have a matrix, I don't know, m by m matrix, how do you write the determinant in terms of the components? So one useful way is the following. You take m, a1, b1, a2, b2, all the way to am, bm. And now you contract all the first indices with a totally antisymmetric tensor. And in principle, you could choose the other ones to just be labels 1 through m, and you will be done. But since I want to treat both indices democratically, I'll also contract them with an epsilon tensor and compensate by an m factorial for my overcount. All right, this is all trivial. But let me apply this to our matrix P. So it's 2x2, so we get 1 over 2, the matrix P. Now, I have to introduce labels for the indices. Okay. Now, I'm going to do something that looks a little strange. I'm going to call this index alpha dot. While I'm calling this index alpha, I'll tell you in a second why I'm doing that. But it's just notation. So according to my definition of a determinant, the way I compute the determinant is by contracting this with a totally antisymmetric tensor for the first indices and a totally antisymmetric tensor for the second index. Now, can anyone guess why these two indices should be distinguished, or why is it nice to put a dot? Why would we bother? I mean, imagine people when write papers on tech, they have to put this dot every time. So there must be a good reason to bother and write dots all over the place. Anyone? Well, the answer is on the board. See? So one of the indices transforms with the action of the group in this way, and the other index transforms in this way. Okay? So we're going to see that more explicitly in a second. All right. This keeps going up. Are you all familiar with SL2C? I mean, this is something that you have seen before, or is it the first time? That would be good to know. Well, it's at least the second time, because yesterday we mentioned SL2C. But SL2C is going to play a role, a very, very important role in all the lectures, not only this week, but also next week and so on. So it would be great if you could review the structure of SL to see how it acts, its connection to the Lorentz group. Okay, so back to gluons. All right, so gluons are massless particles. And what it means is that the momentum is null. So its norm is zero, which means that if we go to our fancy notation, the determinant of this vanishes. Well, but that sounds interesting. So every time you have a matrix whose determinant vanishes, it means that the columns or the rows satisfy some linear relation. So let's actually write that linear relation. Our 2x2 matrix, given that the determinant vanishes and is a single condition, it means that it has rank 1 instead of 2. And therefore, we can assume, say, that the rows or that the columns are proportional to each other. So let's say that the columns, let me call them like this. This is a column vector. So the two columns are going to be proportional to some vector that I'm going to call AB, to some column vector called AB. And what would be the constant of proportionality? So I'm going to say that this whole thing, this whole AB, I'm going to multiply by something that I'm going to call A tilde. And this one, I'm going to multiply it by another constant that I'm going to call B tilde. It's just my choice. This is a way to represent the most general 2x2 matrix whose determinant vanishes. So when I put this in here, I get this. But you see that this is also nice, because I could also have thought about this as two rows that happen to be proportional. And the constant of proportionality is A and B. So the two pictures are equivalent. So I haven't made any choices. So I'm actually parameterizing the most general matrix that has this structure. But this matrix can also be written as the product of this object and this object. Just a matrix multiplication, right? So any rank 1 matrix, 2x2 matrix, can be written like this. Of course, all of you who do quantum information know that very well. All right. So now it's going to be clear why we decided to introduce this notation for the indices alpha and alpha dot. The reason is the following. It's very convenient, or people, or that's the tradition, to denote this object as follows. People use the letter lambda for the components of this object, and the letters lambda tildes for the component of this object. And now you see that SL2C, when it acts on this matrix, the way it acts is as a 2x2 matrix acting on this object to produce a new kind of a new object. And it acts on this one to produce another one. So every time you have a two-dimensional object where SL2C acts in this form, you call this, well, it's really in the fundamental representation of SL2C, but from the point of view of the Lorentz group, this is called a spinner. In fact, both of them are spinners, and these ones are called left movers or left-handed, left spinners of negative chirality and spinners of positive chirality. Sometimes they call it left spinners, right spinners. It doesn't matter. They are both spinners, and they transform differently. So you don't really want to mix them. So when people type papers, they bother to put the dot in order to give you information about how this object transforms. So just by seeing the index with a dot, it tells you that it transforms like this. And the index without a dot, it tells you that it transforms like this. So it's very important information. Sorry?
Last formula should have had dots?
It didn't have dots, yes. They were very small. That's why you couldn't see them. All right. So the last thing we have to do before we actually get to do some amplitudes is Mandelstam invariance. So this part of the lectures is like anytime you have to learn, you want to learn a new language. So all we're doing is building vocabulary and writing new and new words in the new language, right? So hopefully you are all familiar with Mandelstam invariance. When you have four particles, these are the famous S, T, and U. But in general, we want to construct combinations of vectors of this form. You take any two gluons, you add their momenta, and you square it. This object, it's a Lorentz invariant. And you would expect that your amplitudes will strongly depend on them. Now, this is something we all know, but we want to write them again, building our dictionary, which is extremely boring and painful. But we have to do it. We have to write this in terms of our new variables. So for each particle, we don't want to think about momentum anymore. What we want to do is to think about these spinners. So for particle A, our matrix is the matrix constructed from these spinners. And for particle B, our 2x2 matrix is constructed from these spinners. We can put the indices. How do we express this in terms of that? Well, again, the answer is on the blackboard, not on this one. As a hint, it's on the other one. So what is this? This is nothing but the norm of the vector Ka plus Kb, right? So this whole thing, we can think about this as a vector p. That's what it is. And we can apply the formula over there. We agree that the norm of this vector was equal to the determinant of the matrix p, which is a half. Now written in this notation, it would be the matrix Ka, Kb, alpha, alpha dot, Ka plus Kb, beta, beta dot, epsilon, alpha, beta, epsilon, alpha dot, beta dot. Very good. Now, we just have to hit this thing with each other. So if you have this guy with this guy, you see what's going to happen, right? If we use that formula over there, we're going to find that this with itself is zero. But that's good, because it was supposed to be a null vector. This with itself is going to be zero again. And we're only going to get the cross term. And the cross term will cancel these two, because we're going to get it twice. And we just get something that looks like this. Ka alpha alpha dot, Kb beta beta dot, epsilon alpha dot beta dot, which now we can apply these formulas into here and regroup every alpha index, every undotted index together. So we're going to get the lambda of this particle and the lambda of this particle contracted with this. So we get the lambda of A, the lambda of B, contracted with alpha and beta. And on the other side, we're going to get everything the same, but now replacing tildes and tilde with tildes and undotted with dotted indices. Now, these two objects cannot possibly talk to each other under a Lorentz transformation. They transform in different ways. So they must be Lorentz invariants by themselves. So these objects are Lorentz invariants and they deserve a name, especially because we're going to write amplitudes in terms of them. So we don't want to write this all over and over again. So this one looks like an inner product of two objects, of the lambdas. So why not denote it like this? Looks good. About this one, well, we cannot use these brackets anymore because we already did. So people came out with a brilliant notation for that, which is actually terrible. It looks like a commutator. But, well, that's life. I didn't invent it, so it's not my fault. So that's a standard convention for this thing. It's not a commutator, so. Not a commutator. In fact, these guys are not matrices, even, right? Square matrices. These guys are just these tiny vectors. Now, in order to even make things faster for you to type or to write, we're also going to sometimes write this just like this. And this one, like this. So finally, we get our formula for the Mandelstam invariant. And it's pretty nice. Just given by that. OK. So we're almost done with the kinematics we need. So we have translated the color into some trace convention that you didn't see before, that you hadn't seen before. We have translated the momentum vectors into some new variables that you hadn't seen before. What is left? What else do we have to translate? I told you that gluons come with three pieces of data, and we have dealt with two of them. What's the last piece of data we're missing? You can check in your notes. You were taking notes.
Polarization.
Exact polarization vectors. And that's what we're about to do. Now, polarization vectors. OK, so we could spend a whole lecture talking about polarization vectors. These are not really vectors, just as amplitudes are not really functions. They are distributions. Here, these guys are not vectors because they don't transform as vectors. They do something more complicated. But for us, let's be more pragmatic and simply say, well, what do we want? We want to construct these objects. They have four indices. And what do we want out of them? We want these objects to have the following property. Every time you give me a gluon, its corresponding polarization vector is supposed to be transverse to the gluon momentum. So we are supposed to produce, to ask for this to happen. Now, this is only one condition, and we are supposed to go from four components to 2 degrees of freedom. So the way to do that is by imposing that every time in our physical calculations, if you replace your polarization vector for this particle by another polarization vector that differs from the first one by something proportional to the momentum of the particle, this is just a constant of proportionality, we are supposed to get the same object. So we are supposed to mod out by this redundancy. This is supposed to be a redundancy of any calculation that you do. And for convenience, I'll ask these polarization vectors to be null vectors. For obvious reasons. Now we can use all the technology we have developed to deal with this condition, and hopefully this condition as well. So let's see how that works. So let's actually write them in the way we're going to use them. Let's use condition one. It's a null vector, therefore its associated matrix, which guess what? It's gonna be this, can be written as the product of two spinors, one of one chirality and another one of another chirality. So let me call these spinors chi. In order not to confuse them with the spinors that we had already for the momentum. Okay? This is the most general parametrization that solves condition one. How about condition two? Well, we also know how to compute the dot product of two vectors. We have it there in the box. So 2 times epsilon dot k, if we have that our matrix k is given by lambda alpha, lambda tilde alpha dot, is nothing but lambda with chi and lambda tilde with chi tilde. But we need this to be 0. That's the condition. So either chi lambda is equal to 0, or chi tilde, lambda tilde is equal to 0. So we have exactly 2 possibilities. Isn't that nice? What else do we have at 2? Right on top. We need 2 physical degrees of freedom, and we have exactly 2 solutions to the problem. What do you think it means when 2 spinors give you 0 when you contract them with the epsilon tensor? Think about these spinors as little vectors in R2. So you have them, these are 2 component objects in a 2-dimensional space. What is this contraction? What is it measuring? Any ideas? So let's write chi lambda more explicitly is chi 1 lambda 2 minus chi 2 lambda 1. This is also the determinant of chi 1, chi 2, lambda 1, lambda 2. So if you think about this as a little vector in R2, and this one as another vector in R2, you're computing the determinant. And the determinant is measuring the angle between the 2 vectors. If the angle is equal to 0, it means that the 2 vectors are proportional to each other. So every time you get something like this, it's telling you that these 2 spinors are proportional to each other. So in option 1, we get that our spinor chi has to be proportional to the spinor lambda, and I'm just going to set them equal, because after all, I haven't told you what chi tilde is. So whatever constant of proportionality appears here, I can absorb it in chi tilde. Option 2, this one would be equal to this. So our polarization vectors for option 1 will look like this. And for option 2, they will look like this. Finally, we have to impose, or we have to use this condition somehow. But that condition comes from the fact that we haven't said anything, or we don't have any way of fixing this chi and this chi tildes. So chi and chi tilde in these formulas, not here, of course, but correspondingly, are reference spinors. And therefore, different choices of reference spinors should correspond to momentum polarization vectors that differ by a power, by just something that is proportional to the momentum of the particle. Is that true here? If you choose any other chi tilde, for example, here, would you get something proportional to the original thing plus something that is proportional to the momentum vector? Well, the answer is no. It doesn't look like that. In fact, so if you rescale this by a factor of 3, this guy just gets rescaled by a factor of 3. It seems that we're in trouble. Somehow, we need this chi tilde to be a reference object that is independent of the scale. So how can we achieve that? Well, let's say that this guy actually is a spinner, and we want to absorb the scale of this guy somehow so that this guy will be scaleless as you scale this guy by some factor. So the way to do it is by dividing by the same power of this thing. It's like normalizing this spinner to have norm 1 or something like that. But how can we do it in a way that is Lorentz invariant? So we have to write here in the denominator something that is Lorentz invariant. But the only objects that we have at our disposal are the lambdas of the particle k and the lambda tildes of particle k and this guy. So here is one proposal. We can just contract this guy with the lambda tilde of the particle that we are considering. Now this guy is invariant under rescalings. So that looks pretty good. In this case, the proposal would be to introduce a spinner like this and contract it with the lambda of the particle. Now, would this correspond to that transformation if we change mu into any other reference spinner? Well, the answer is yes, because this is a two-dimensional object which I can expand in any basis of two-dimensional objects. And I choose the basis to be mu tilde and lambda tilde. So it's an exercise for you to plug this into this formula and show that you're going to recover the same polarization vector as the original one, plus something that is proportional to the momentum of the particle. And the momentum of the particle, as a 2x2 matrix, is just lambda times lambda. Okay. So we have everything we need now. Any questions? This is the right moment to take a 1-minute break. We have introduced so much notation, so many things that are new. But it would all look disappointing if we don't use it for something. So let's at least do 3 particles. Let's try and determine an amplitude before the end of the lecture. It would be disappointing if we did all this and we didn't write anything. So let's do 3 particles. Well, we could start again with Feynman diagrams, write down the formula using Feynman diagrams, unplugging all the new technology we have and see what the answer looks like. Well, but that would be a little boring. Let's do something that is a little faster. Let's use momentum conservation to realize that there is something very special about 3 particles that is not true for any more particles. And that is the fact that if you move one of the particles, one of the momenta to the other side, you can square this and conclude that this is equal to 0. So k1 dot k2 is equal to 0 because this is a null vector. And therefore, this product has to be equal to 0. But 3 was not special. I could move to the other side 1 or 2, and then conclude that 2k1 dot k3 is equal to 0, which would mean that 1, 3 x13 is equal to 0, or that 2k1 dot or 2.k3 is equal to 0, which would imply that 2.3 is equal to 0. Now we have to solve that system of equations. Well, you have the product of two things equal to 0, so it's either this is equal to 0 or this is equal to 0. So let's choose this is equal to 0. That means that the little vector lambda 1 tilde and lambda 2 tilde are proportional to each other. OK, very good. What choice will you make here? Well, you could choose this equal to 0 or this equal to 0. Let's try lambda 1, 3 equal to 0. This one equal to 0. This bracket equal to 0 means that 1 and 3 are proportional to each other. But if 1 and 2 are proportional to each other and 1 and 3 are proportional to each other, what happens to 2 and 3? Are also proportional to each other. So this implies already that 2 and 3 are equal to 0. So we don't get to make any choice for this one. This one was made for us the moment we made this choice. Now you see that we have three equations with two possible conditions for each. So we always have to make two choices that are equal to each other, either two angular brackets equal to each other or two square brackets equal to each other. But the moment you make two, any of these choices, the third one is implied already. So even though it seems that we have eight possibilities, the eight possibilities have gone down to only two. OK? That means that whatever answer we have, so whatever is our amplitude for three particles, it has to be a function, in this case, of the objects that are not zero. And in this case, our amplitude, we have to be a function, again, of the objects that are not zero. What other hint we have? Let me ask you something. When you compute the scattering amplitudes of gluons, or even if you have external fermions or anything, but think about the scattering amplitudes of gluons or photons, where do the polarization vectors go? Do they ever appear twice? Do they ever appear in the denominator? What are the polarization vectors? They are wave functions for this part. So every polarization vector has to appear how many times? So in any scattering amplitude, every polarization vector, the polarization vector for particle 1, appears just once when you insert it in the line in any Feynman diagram. The polarization vector appears exactly once, contracted with something. Polarization vector for particle 2 appears exactly once, and so on. So any scattering amplitude is the product of polarization vectors contracted with a mess of indices made out of momentum and metrics. So this object only depends on the metric of space-time and the moment of the particles. All the dependence on the polarization vectors is always in this form. There is no other way. OK. Can we use that to our advantage in our fancy notation? Well, we got two possibilities for our polarization vectors. We got this one. And this one. So people give names to these polarizations. So they say that this corresponds to a particle that carries helicity minus one, and this a particle that carries helicity plus one. The reason why it's called helicity, we can discuss it after the lecture if you want. But you all knew, well, even in electrodynamics, photons also carry helicity, and they also come with two different possible helicity. So this is a one with helicity minus one, and this is a one with helicity plus one. And you see that there is an interesting difference in that if you rescale, in an amplitude, if you rescale the lambda of the particle by some factor and the lambda tilde by the inverse power of that factor, what happens to the momentum of the particle? Do we have any expression for the momentum of the particle? I don't have it. Let's write it here. The momentum stays invariant, but not the polarization vectors. So this one will pick a factor of t squared, one from here and one from this one that will come up to the numerator. And this one will pick a factor of t to the minus 2, 1 over t squared. So if you have an amplitude and your particle carries helicity HA, would it be plus or minus 1, then once you perform this transformation, since polarization vectors only enter in this form, the amplitude has to scale with a power that is correlated with the helicity in this way. So you see there is a triviality once you realize that the only way you can get the rescaling is from the polarization vectors. Each polarization vector enters only once, and depending on the helicity of the particle, you will get either t squared or 1 over t squared. Okay? So if we have this, let's try to write down the answer if we assume that particle 1 carries helicity minus 1, particle 2 carries helicity minus 1, and particle 3 carries helicity plus 1. Now, this is a very difficult problem. We have to write a function that depends on these objects that does this. So we have only at our disposal the three angular brackets to some powers that we have to determine. So that if we rescale this guy by some t, we're going to get exactly two powers of t. If we rescale this one by t, we're supposed to get two powers of t. And if we rescale this one, we're supposed to get 1 over t squared. What kind of function could that possibly be? Well, I'm not going to give this as an exercise because it's too easy. I'm just going to give you the answer. This is the only possibility that does what we want. If you rescale 1 by t, we get 3 powers in the numerator and 1 power in the denominator, giving you what you wanted. Same thing for 2, and 3 gives you 2 powers in the denominator. So that's our very first amplitude. All right. And now we are ready to end the lecture with what we called yesterday the Park-Taylor miracle. So Park and Taylor, they were not looking for anything fancy. All they wanted to do was to compute amplitudes for the collider. Which collider, by the way? Do you know? At the time, we didn't have the LHC. So it actually was the Tevatron. So our friends here were actually sitting at Fermilab. And the experimentalists were poking them, saying, look, somebody has to do these calculations, and they decided to do it. They knew about color decomposition, so that wasn't new. They knew about these variables, so that wasn't new. But they only had Feynman diagrams, so they took Feynman diagrams, and they applied these to the Feynman diagrams. So for three particles, indeed they got what we are saying. Let me actually write like this, because somehow it looks nicer. Looks nicer because the denominator now has this cyclic structure. And the only way we break the cyclic structure is by the way the helicity is entered. So they did this, and they also knew they needed the four-particle amplitude with these helicities. So they took the 100 terms, changed variables, and simplified as much as they could, and they found this answer. Isn't that nice? I said, wow, okay. Could it be? Could it be that this is a pattern? So they computed the, of course, we are physicists, right? So we did one case, another case, so it must be a theorem. So we do this. And guess what? Yes, they found that, the same thing. And that's as much as they could do. Five particles had these 3,400 terms. So you couldn't really go to six particles. It would be extremely hard. But they made a conjecture. So first of all, they also did these ones. So this is all plus. All helicities are plus one. They did it for 3, 4, 5, and then they conjectured that it was true for any, and the answer is 0. Now this is one, it's called the one minus. For obvious reasons. So there is only one minus and the rest are pluses. So they also did the 3, 4, 5. Well, in this case, the three particle amplitude is not 0, but that one is special, and they knew. So they did this one, and they also found 0. And then the most famous one, because very hard to get famous just by getting zeros. And you, or to get a formula named after you if the formula happens to be 0. So this one, which is actually called the Park-Taylor formula, is, now here I'm going to write it in the most general form. Very boring, but. So only I and J have minus helicity. The rest will have plus. Of course, the denominator, you can guess it. How about the numerator? Can you guess what the numerator has to be?
IJ.
Exactly. We can check immediately that it has the correct properties under the rescaling. For every particle that is plus, we get 1 over t squared because they always appear twice in the denominator. So that's a check mark. For every particle of helicity minus, they appear four times in the numerator, but no need to worry, because they also appear two times in the denominator. So we get a t squared in the numerator. Of course, that's not a proof, but it's a... it's a consistency, it's a sanity check. Very good. Now, you would say, okay, so we're on a roll. What happens if we put another minus instead? So we had no minuses, one minus, two minuses. Now you try three minuses, and all hell breaks loose. Now, nothing nice seems to happen. So that's where things stood in 1996, and they stay like that. Nair took this formula and thought about this as a correlation function on the sphere, and it was all very nice. But then, as I said, you could take that as the reason why this guy had to be so simple and nothing nice was going to happen to the other ones. So the question became, what happens to all the others? Is there anything nice that happens to them? And of course, the answer is yes, but we had to wait until 2003 for that to happen. All right. So I think we can stop. It's a good place to stop.